Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing the first in a series of some of the most remarkable interviews I have done over the last few years. These interviews are remarkable not only because the talent of the people I'm interviewing is remarkable, but because of the way they stumbled into, found their way, were discovered, couldn't help but arrive at the art which became their life. This first interview is the first half of an interview I did with Duncan Lamont. It's amazing. So, hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice, oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
Welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is all about discovering, recovering, uncovering who you really are, and then allowing yourself to consider becoming it. If you've been listening, you know, and if you haven't been listening, I'm going to tell you that as a psychotherapist who's been in practice more than 30 years, I am convinced that virtually none of us is actually completely demonstrating who we really are. Pretty much all of us are keeping secrets about ourselves, and not only secrets about ourselves from other people, but secrets about who we are from ourselves. That we have learned early in our life that some parts of ourselves were dangerous to express. They would bring criticism or teasing, neglect, maybe even punishment. Or at the very least, they would not bring what we wanted, which was affection, attention, care, safety. And so early on in our lives, we make these decisions and we become able to hide those qualities which we decided were not going to bring us what we want, or we're going to bring us something we didn't want, and lead with the qualities that somehow were the ones our family either wanted us to be or thought we would be or made us feel we had to be. And we're so good at it that in a very short space of time we forget that this is just an act. We have a cover story, and then we have all the rest of ourselves, which is undercover, and we forget all those things that are undercover. But I believe that many, many times it is precisely what we have hidden undercover that we need in order to live the fullest and the most satisfying life that we can live. And so my show and also my work is dedicated to helping people discover those things that they have had to hide and get access to them. And that's not a simple process. And I talk in most of my shows about why and how we hide these things, why and how we can recover them, and why it might be difficult once even we know we have them to get access to them. The other thing I do in my shows is interview people who make their living or their life with their art. And that is because these people, in order to do that in this culture, it has to be who you really are, because nobody would do it in this culture. It's so hard. For the next, I think, 9 weeks, I am replaying some of the most remarkable interviews that I've done. I discovered something really amazing, and that is that many of the people I have interviewed, whose entire life have been dedicated to an art, didn't choose it, didn't know it was them, didn't go looking for it, that it came to them, came at them, emerged from them, all kinds of bizarre and ironic ways that they got captured. And the person who, the first half of whose interview I'm doing today is Duncan Lamont. And the best way I can describe what happened to Duncan is that in a way he got picked up by the scruff of his neck, by life, and essentially forced to recognize what is a remarkably prodigious talent. This life, which has brought so much joy and happiness and pleasure in virtually every aspect that one can, in terms of music, to our world, would have been completely lost in the life he expected to live, which was working in the mines. The mind boggles. Anyway, this is Duncan's story, and it makes the point that, actually, I'm not sure what point it makes, but the point that it makes is being made over and over again in the interviews that I'm doing in the next in 2 months. Something magical is sometimes at work, and some people respond to that. Maybe that's all I can say about this. It's striking because for me, it comes up over and over again in these interviews. And so I decided to put a bunch of them together that all make this point, and you can arrive at whatever conclusion you decide to arrive at. If you manage to listen to a few of these. So here is Duncan's version of magical. Here is the delightful, talented, sweet, warm, dear Duncan Lamont. So I am here with Duncan Lamont in my kitchen because he was kind enough to come and talk to me. I'm going to explain to him that on my radio show, I do a series called Anatomy of an Artist.
Oh, yeah.
And I like to interview people who have made their living or their life with their art.
Yeah.
Which you have clearly done.
Yes.
And so I like to ask them how that happened to them. How did they find it? How did it find them? How did it begin? How did it get started?
Yeah.
So can you tell me?
Yeah, more or less, I think. It happened when I was about 3 years old. I had two sisters, and they took me to see a movie called The Merry Widow, which is a funny thing to take a talk to, isn't it? But mm-hmm. it took me to see the show, because I mean, going to the movies was it's like going to church. It was just that everyone did it, you know, regardless of what the picture was about. I remember when I came back, I sang The Merry Widow. You know the tune, da 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 da
da da da da da. You're kidding.
Yeah, I sang the tune, and everybody went, "Ah, that's wonderful."
Oh, yeah.
And I thought, hey, this is great, this is show business. And that started me off.
Well, wait a minute. There were two pretty amazing things. One, that you heard it and learned it at three.
Yeah, it was pretty good, wasn't it?
Yeah. Pretty good.
Yeah.
And then, of course, that you got so much encouragement.
Yes.
And you thought, this is a good thing, I'll do this, right?
Yeah, and that was me.
And you remember it?
Yeah, I remember it, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So then what?
And then my sister, my father was an accordion player, and my sister was an accordion player. My other sister was a dancer.
Oh, so there was a lot of music in the house.
Yeah, she was a Scottish dancer. And as I said before to people, she was really the Charlie Parker of Scottish dancing. She was fantastic. I mean, just a wonderful... She won 200 gold medals before she was 13.
Oh, my God!
Yeah. And she had a dancing class of 80 pupils when she was 13, which is... When I think back on...
Oh, my God!
Incredible for a child.
It's incredible.
Yeah. But the other incredible thing about her was the fact that she suffered from bronchitis.
Oi.
And at times she would go up to the stage and she was gasping. Every breath was a nightmare for her to take. But as soon as she stepped onto the stage, she danced so beautifully, like an angel. And she came off and then she was wrecked with breathlessness again.
You mean that while she was dancing, she was breathing?
Yeah.
That's remarkable.
Yeah, it is, yeah. When I think back on it, yeah, well, it really was quite incredible. And then when I was about seven, I wanted to play a musical instrument, and the only one that was for sale was a trumpet for 30 shillings, which was like $1.50 or whatever. And it was the cheapest one, so that was what I got, 30 pieces of silver. And I just started playing the trumpet. And I played...
Well, wait a minute, no lessons? Just...
Well, I mean, I went to a teacher who was, he was just terrible, he was just awful, because he was a shipyard worker and he played the trumpet a bit. And I thought he was teaching me music, but he was teaching me up piano copies, you know, the sort you bought for, you know, a shilling or something like that, and I thought I could read music. And eventually I went to a wonderful teacher in Glasgow. And he said, "Can you read music?" I said, "Yeah." And he put a piece of music down that was just like, I looked, I said, "I can't play that. I expect to see pictures, you know, like a shilling copy of Frank Sinatra or something." So really, he said, "Oh, don't worry," he said, "I'll teach you." And I became like his star pupil, because I was so dumb. I didn't know the trumpet was difficult. I just sort of played everything in the Haydn Trumpet Concerto, everything. I just, as a matter of fact, he used to bring people who were on the road from London. They come to Scotland, and he used to say, he played the piano, and he used to say to me, "Duncan, come on, play the Carnival of Venice or whatever." And there'd be like four trumpet players watching me, and I was about, you know, 12 or something. 11 or 12, and I used to sort of rattle this thing off. And these guys used to look at me, and I never knew it was difficult.
Well, this is just a family of prodigies here.
Well, I mean, not really. No.
Oh, yes.
I mean, it sounds like that, but it really wasn't.
What do you think it was?
But, I mean, the outcome was that when I was 13, I did my first gig, and in Greenock, it was playing with an accordion player.
Trumpet and accordion?
Yeah. Coming home parties. And coming home parties, say, that was for prisoners of war coming home.
Oh.
And so we used to play about 4 or 5 hours. And I was so stupid. I didn't realize that your lip actually get tired. And I actually ruined my own mission. And I just kept playing in hour after hour. And I went back to see the teacher. And I said, I've got some problems. And he said, let me hear you play. And I played, and he burst into tears.
Yes.
He said,
what have you done?
Duncan, what have you done? I said, I don't know. I didn't know. And my embouchure was never right after that. It was never consistent. But I mean, then I got forced into a contest, which I hate. And I got forced to do the writing as well. And I didn't know anything about arranging. I didn't even know that people, they did it on scores and all the instruments were sort of lined up. So I did a trumpet part, which I copied out, and I did a trombone part. But I didn't know the trombone was in bass clef for a start. But the trombonist took the part home and copied it, and I did the alto part. So they all took the parts home, and eventually we went into this contest, and we did incredibly well. You know, we won individualist awards and all types of things. And we got to the All-Scottish, which was a big deal because we came from Greenock. And, I mean, Glasgow was like Las Vegas next to Greenock, you know. And it was just incredible. And anyway, we got to the All-Scottish, and there was this maniac, and he really was insane, a guy called Kenny Graham, who was a very good musician. And he was like a star because there were two small groups in Britain. There was the Johnny Dankworth Seven, which was very, very popular. And this guy, Kenny Graham, and his Afro-Cubists, and he was a saxophone player, and he said to me, I was playing trumpet at the time, and we went in to be criticized, you know, your time is bad, you know, you're playing up tune, you know, usual sort of criticism that judges make. And the first thing he said to me was, in bright red hair, he was a really belligerent guy, he said to me, those solos you played, I sort of reeled back, I thought, oh, this is it, you know. And he said, were they written out? And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, did you write out the solos? And I said, well, no. And he said, well, do you want to join my band in London? I said, oh, thanks very much, Mr. Grimm, but no thanks. He said, well, why not? I said, I'm too frightened. He said,
how old are you now?
No, I'll be 78 and on the 4th of
July. No, not today. I mean, when this was going on.
When this was, I was 19.
Oh, God.
And I said, no, I'm too frightened. I was working in the shipyards at the time. And he said, well, look, you've got to come to London.
You've been working in the shipyards.
And I said, no, I'm too frightened. I prefer the shipyards, you know, the safety of the shipyards. And he said, look, we didn't even have a telephone. We had no money whatsoever. He said, what's your address? And he kept sending me telegrams. And I was in Greenock. He was in London. Phone this number, collect, and I'd go down to the post box down the street, and I'd phone out. He'd say, are you joining my band? I'd say, no. Why not? I'm too frightened, I told you. And this went on for ages and ages. Kept sending telegrams. And finally, one day I was outside the shipyard, and there was this wonderful, wonderful drummer who was in my little band, a guy who eventually played with everybody, Sonny Stitt, Stan Getz, Sonny Rollins, a guy called Jackie Dugan, one of the great drummers. And Jackie was working in the shipyards as well, and he said to me, are you going to London? Because he was desperate that I went to London. I said, no, I'm not going to London. No, I refused him the other night. And he said something which is like pivotal in your whole life. It's funny how one statement can change your whole life. It was 8 o'clock in the morning. We're queuing to get into this hellhole. The shipyards is a nightmare, terrible job. And we're actually queuing to get in to this place 8 o'clock in the morning. He said, Duncan, could anything be worse than this?
Wow.
And at that precise moment, it started to rain. And I looked at the sky, I took my cap up, and I said, I think I'll take the gig after all. And I joined Kenny Graham's band, which was lovely. It was a great experience because he was mad, but he was very, very kind with me, very encouraging. And And I tried to leave every week, you know, tried to leave. And I used to say, I'm leaving. No, you're not leaving. I'd say, well, I can't play. I like what you can't play, used to say. And because I found a way to play without using the trumpet the way I used to, you know, that I was playing one octave, one register. And one day I said to him, one night I said, Kenny, I'm definitely leaving. And he said, well, you sure? I said, yeah, I'm going back to Scotland. I'm going to change my own bassoon and try and get my trumpet playing back. He said, well, I'll be seeing you again. He said, you might not be playing the same instrument, but I'll be seeing you again.
Wow.
Which was very prophetic.
Yes.
So anyway, I went back to Scotland and there was no money. My father was ill and there's no money in the house. So I took a job in a Palais band in Glasgow on third trumpet. And I bought a saxophone I put a deposit on the saxophone, let's put it that way. I had no money to buy a saxophone. And I practiced the saxophone during the breaks. And then after about 2 months, 2 or 3 months, I got a job playing trumpet and saxophone, swapping about. And I did that for another 3 months. And then I finally got a telegram. They used to send telegrams in those days to join a band in Glasgow on saxophone. So I took the trumpet and threw it across the room.
Said, goodbye.
You've caused me enough trouble. And that was like the start of my career as a woodwind player anyway. And after about 3 or 4 months playing this band, I got a job with a really great band. It was like a Woody Herman type band. Mm-hmm. And I was playing lead tenor. And I thought, it's funny to think that a year before I took that gig, I didn't even know the fingering on the saxophone. And yet everything was in lead tenor. And the first week there was a broadcast with a long, long tenor solo of East of the Sun. And I thought about it recently, I thought, it's weird to think that a year before, I wouldn't have known. If somebody said, there's a saxophone, I'd have said, well,
what do you do with it?
What do you do with it? Where do you put your fingers? So,
Well, you're a pretty quick study.
No, I don't think so. I don't think I've been very quick at anything, actually. But, I mean, then I had to take up... I came to London, and it's funny, I was working with a band in London, and this wonderful trumpet player, and another maniac, I mean, really, really insane guy, but incredibly talented. He was a very, very good writer. And he used to turn up at the rehearsals for this band in his pajamas with an overcoat on, you know, so just gives you an idea. And he recommended me for a job in an name band that was just starting up. And I was getting £11 a week, which was very, very good in at that time in London, because the wages were about, the average was about £7. So I thought, like a millionaire. But I get this job. The guy phoned me up in the ballroom. He said, do you want to join this band? He said, it's 4 nights a week at £5 a week, which was like a fortune. And he said, we're doing broadcasts and we're doing films, features of the band. And sure enough, and so I went from making £11 a week to making about £100 a week, which was incredible in those days. And I was so stupid, I didn't even have a bank account or a post office account. I used to just throw bundles of notes in a drawer, you know. And there were like hundreds of pounds, and it didn't even bother me. And then one day I got a call from, again, a guy called Jimmy Watson, the insane guy who used to appear in his pajamas. And he said, there's a broadcast, a guy called Johnny Keating, who was a very well-known writer. He used to write for Ted Heath's band, and he had like a studio orchestra. And this album was called Swingin' Scots. And it was all Scottish people. That's why I was there, you see. And Jimmy Watson was Scottish also. So he recommended me to Johnny Keating. So on the first, I remember the first thing, he must have thought, I wonder what this guy plays like. I better let him have a solo first. And there was another guy called Tommy Whittle, very, very good player, very fine, fast, like a Ben Webster, Stan Getz, mm-hmm. if you can imagine that combination. With an illustrious career behind him. Just a young guy, but I mean, he'd worked with Ted Heath for a long time, he did his own quartet. So the first tune, I had a solo to play, and I was really nervous, you know. And I played the solo, and I thought I played terrible, but instantly Johnny fell in love with the way I played. And he switched the solos from Tommy, Tommy, let Duncan play this one.
Oh my.
And it was, and I saw Johnny Keating recently, he said, I still feel embarrassed when I see Tommy Whittle. It's because I switched everything up. I mean, I was embarrassed because it was like, I was like a learner, really. I'd only been playing about two or three years. And Tommy was really, he is still a wonderful player. And it was embarrassing because it was like, a bit like All About Eve, you know, sort of taking from the stars, set this up.
Well, exactly, but you didn't try.
I didn't.
That's the difference,
I was very, very embarrassed by the whole thing. And it came to the end, and Johnny was famous for not writing enough music. He was always in trouble, always writing at the last moment. And we had about 5 minutes to go, and Tommy was supposed to do the small group with and a wonderful baritone player called Ronnie Ross in the rhythm section. And Johnny said, oh, Duncan will do this. And so the guys were packing up, and I said, he said, Duncan, we've got 5 minutes. 5 minutes. And I said, well, where's the music? He said, there's no music. Make something up. It's my first recording session. I had 5 minutes to make something up. So my, well, let's do, and I just sort of played a little riff, and we recorded it like that. And it was so haphazard, I actually forgot the riff at the end of the tune. But I mean, then I got a call the next day from the guy who used to book everything in London, a guy called Charlie Katz, who was like the Nero of the bookers. If you didn't work for Charlie Katz, you didn't work at all. I mean, it was terrible, really. It was power, you know.
Yes.
And it's all different now, thank God. But I mean, I got a call from this guy, Charlie Katz. He said, my name's Charlie Katz. He said, oh, hello. He said, Johnny Keating said, I have to book you on everything that he's doing. So I went from doing, well, I was on the road with bands, but I went from that to doing film sessions and things that when I saw, I didn't know anything about a downbeat, you know, a 5/8, a 5/4, which happens a lot in films, you know. And it was a terrifying experience, because when the guy went downbeat, I had a thing to play, and I didn't play at all. And he said, well, why didn't you play? I said, well, can you go 1, 2, 3, 4? I said, no, I can't go 1, 2, 3, 4. It's a downbeat. I'm going like that. And I said, oh, okay. And he went, and I came in. But luckily, there was always a nightclub scene at the end. And although I never get sent home, I'll never know, because I couldn't really play the flute, I couldn't really play the clarinet, couldn't play the bass clarinet, and all these, and I was hiding behind people, and studio musicians are very kind. If it's something difficult, the guy would say, Duncan, I'll play this. And if there was a tenor solo, he'd say, Duncan, you do this. But there was always a nightclub scene where they'd say, Duncan, stay behind. And so it was always called the Blue something. It was like the Blue Angel or the nightclub. It was always in British films, the Blue Lagoon, the Blue something. And there was always this scene where I played the tenor, and the guys would say, yeah, it's lovely, beautiful. So I got booked on film sessions, and I couldn't even read the music. But I mean, I had to take up the flute, the clarinet, and start practicing, and I got reasonably good. I never get sent home, but I was never I played them in a musical way, but I never did any technique on the instruments, because these guys had been through the war, and they were like first clarinet players with the Marines band, and they play anything. I mean, the most difficult things, they just sort of rattle it off, you know, Rhapsody in Blue, No Trouble, you know, look at the word, and it's like, and I'd say, how do you do that? And it was the same with flute players and piccolo players and things like that. And of course the bass clarinet as well. And then I had to play all the saxophones like the baritone, the alto, the soprano. I just had to take them up because they would just book you and say, oh by the way, bring a baritone. I didn't even own a baritone. I didn't even know how it sounded, you know. But I've turned up and I'd find a way. I mean, I wrote a book once called The Street Fighter's Guide to Improvisation and explained it. And I said, you know, you really had to be a street fighter. By fair means or foul, you found a way to do something. So that was it. And then I got very, very much involved in studios. I was doing about 3 studio dates a day. And
still in London.
In London. And it was a wonderful time because people came over, like Sinatra came over. Jack Jones had like a permanent orchestra on the road, you know. And he just toured around Britain. Jack was there for about 2 or 3 years. So there was so much work. If I was in the studios, I was working with Sammy Davis, Dean Martin, Shirley MacLaine, Marlene Dietrich, or Frank, or whatever, and I mean, I never ever stopped working. You know, it was a very, very busy time, very good time. You know, it was a wonderful halcyon days of music, really.
Mm-hmm.
So then I get involved in writing. I used to do an annual quartet broadcast, and this is really strange because I was so busy in studios and everything seemed to be solos. I mean, I'd walk in and be like a symphony orchestra there in one chair for a movie, and the guy would say, Duncan, you're sitting there, it's the title music, it's the end music. And so they were quite happy with it, but I wasn't. I was really nervous.
This is like you spent a lifetime being nervous and finding a way to pull it off.
Yeah. Incredible, yeah. And I thought, well, everybody's happy except me, you know, because the strain was incredible.
I'm surprised it didn't take some kind of physical toll on you.
Well, I mean, no, it didn't really, but I mean, eventually I thought, well, I don't want to do it through drink, and I don't want to do it through drugs. And I took a yoga class.
Oh, my God.
And do you know, in a week, it transformed my whole thinking. It transformed my whole attitude. And I suddenly realized that in yoga, like, for instance, the teacher, who was great, she mentioned, she said, some of these poses, some of you will be able to do it easily, and other ones will be almost impossible. And there were things that I could do that were just like second nature, and other things that were almost impossible. Bridget, my wife, would do the impossible things. She just found it easy, and the teacher said, well, you know, it isn't a contest. And I thought then, well, life isn't a contest. And I was constantly thinking, well, what do people think about me? And through yoga, I lost that attitude. I just concentrated, which is the essence of any type of artistry, just intense concentration. So you're unaware of
right. Of
what people, you're not even thinking about what people are thinking. Some people do it through booze, some people do it through drugs. Most of my friends are dead now,
Yeah. Having
done it through booze and drugs. After about a week, or 2 weeks in yoga maybe, the guy phoned me for the annual quartet broadcast, and I said, he said, Duncan, I'd like you to do another broadcast. And I said, well, how many people can I have? And he said, well, how many do you want? I said, well, how about 18 or 20? And he said, okay. And I said, look, I must tell you something. I've never written for a big band before. He said, it's okay, Duncan. You can just write a 12-bar blues. It'll be okay. This guy had utter confidence in me. And I'd never written anything. And I did the first broadcast. And that was like the start of a writing career. Mm-hmm. Because I get involved in broadcasts and writing. And through that, an incredible player, an incredible writer, incredible guy called Steve Gray, who was just wonderful. He said to me one day, do you want to do some library music? He said, I'm thinking of forming a group of writers, of five writers who can write a certain amount of material for the LPs in those days. And result is I formed a group, and we did a great deal of library music. Editors, maybe if they're short of money, if it's a commercial or something, or a film, I need some love music, I need some stripper music.
Right.
And they go to
the library.
The library, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they go, oh yeah, let's listen to that. Oh, that's okay. And it's very lucrative, you know.
Sure.
You can make a lot of money.
After so, you've written it and it's gone, and it just keeps...
Well, then you got a royalty.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
It's wonderful. So I did that. Then the other thing that happened was a friend of mine who lived in Putney at the time, and he lived down the road. I'd met him through... Bridget took a younger son to the kindergarten. And this guy used to turn up with his little boy. And Ross, my son, and he seemed like soulmates. They were just inseparable. And we became very friendly. And he's an illustrator. And he writes a lot of children's books. His name is David McKee. And Dave said to me one day, he said, I'm thinking of writing a television series. Do you want to write the music? I said, yeah, okay. And it was a little character called Mr. Ben. And Mr. Ben was a little guy who... He was a little city gent with a bowler hat and, on, you know, a little tie. And he went to a fancy dress shop. And he looked at the various costumes, you know, spaceman, cowboy, knight's costume, etc. And he picked one. He went to a changing room. And then he came through another door. And once he was through the other door, he was in that land.
He was that.
For 15 minutes, yeah.
Oh, that's adorable.
He was a knight or a cowboy. It's a lovely concept. And at the end of the little adventure, the little man would say, step this way, sir, step back. And little man might be dressed and come through this cave, sir, you know, and you'll find it's quite comfortable. And he'd go there and he'd be back in the changing room and he'd walk through the streets again. I mean, a wonderful story. We did it about 35 years ago, and it's become iconic now. It really is. They have Mr. Ben societies and in Britain, you know, in universities. And as a matter of fact, they were going to do a movie. They were hoping to use Johnny Depp.
As Mr. Ben. Oh, my God.
And do you know the guy, Ben Kingsley?
Of
the
course.
Guy who played...
Mm-hmm.
Well, Ben Kingsley said in an article, he said, it's my life's ambition to play the shopkeeper. The little shopkeeper. You see, a little guy in a Pez hat and a little moustache, little mysterious guy. So, I mean, Mr. Ben is like... I know so many young musicians who are sort of fascinated by the fact I wrote the music for Mr. Ben, because it's just... They say,
it's part of their childhood.
Yeah, it's part of their growing up.
Yes.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Because it was shown all the time at one time. I don't think there are too many programs on television. And it was shown all the time. And I actually did a musical of it before I came over. I did two nights in a school. And I used I just put lyrics to the incidental music. And it was really lovely. I mean, I'm hoping I might be able to do it over here.
Oh,
I was thinking it would really... really great, you know. So, I mean, the parents all knew the music, and the kids knew Mr. Ben, because it's shown a lot on Nickelodeon.
Uh-huh.
And we did a DVD, which Nickelodeon paid for, of all the adventures of Mr. Ben, including a new one where Mr. Ben was a gladiator. He's lovely. But I mean, Mr. Ben has become part of British life. As a matter of fact, I did a thing at the Guildhall once. I did a teaching for a month, for a week there, and we had to go on stage, you know, the very beginning, the teachers, and they said, oh, so-and-so played with so-and-so and so-and-so and so. And it came to me, and they said, Duncan played with so-and-so and so-and-so and so. And all the pupils were sort of bored, and the guy said, and he wrote the music for Mr. Ben. Immediately, everybody was really excited about you. I was saying, did you really write the music for Mr. Ben? And we did the 13 episodes in one afternoon. I mean, it was incredible. There was no other episodes, just 13. And we did it in 3 hours. So, I mean, Mr. Ben has got great memories for me.
Well, you know, I mean, it seems like these things just arrived for you.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't sound like you were trying, you know, initiating, reaching, no. Working. It just sort of all landed.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. But I mean, I've got nothing against people who display their wares in the marketplace.
No, I'm not. No, it's not.
Because that's good, you know.
Yeah, but
you
didn't do it. No. It's almost as though it was meant for you in a way.
In a certain way, then. Then I get involved in songs, strangely enough, writing songs.
So I'm stopping the interview with Duncan there because he started to talk about himself as a songwriter. And next week I'm going to play the second half of this interview and a number of the songs. I'm going to actually play 2 pieces of Duncan Lamont music. Now, I'm going to play a single song called I Did It All For You, which was recorded by Blossom Dearie. And I'm going to send the show out on the Mr. Ben theme, which you may or may not have heard. As Duncan said, it wasn't really played in the United States. But if you're listening in England, then you probably did hear it. So in a minute, I'm going to play the Blossom Dearie cut. I want to say, although I know it's not necessary, I hope that you are enjoying this interview as much as I enjoyed doing it and listening to it. Duncan spontaneously, naturally, easily is just a delight in addition to all of that remarkable talent. So, okay, here is Blossom Dearie doing a version of the Duncan Lamont tune, I Did It All For You. Thank you.
do. I know that if I should ever get to heaven, and they should grant an interview, I'd have to say, you've always made my day, and I did it all, it's true.
Did it all for you. That's the legendary Blossom Dearie doing the legendary Duncan Lamont's song. And we are closing in on the end of the show very, very quickly here. So before I play the Mr. Ben theme, I want to say, as I always do at the end of the show, the most heartfelt thank you to Josh Hackney, who, without whom, there would be no show. Josh, who fixes everything I do wrong, reminds me how to do all the things that I used to know how to do but have somehow forgotten, teaches me to do the things that I need to do when he's not going to be around. And so if you have any need for anything electronic, recording, IT, computer, internet, Josh is the guy. And you can find him and you can find me on the Lynn Show website, thelynneshow. You can also say, tell me how to get in touch with Duncan. I want to know where he's playing. I want to know where to get his songs. I want to learn more about him. And I will make that information available to you as well. And now, right before I play the Mr. Ben theme, and then my own theme, we go out on I Won't Go With a Whimper, which of course is my song, I want to say that I hope that you heard something you can use today, or at least something that made you laugh, as you heard it certainly made me laugh, or smile, or warmed the cockles of your you-know-what, or something that intrigued you or interested you, or anyway, something that'll bring you back, because I will be back again next week, same time, same station, and boy, I sure hope you will be too. Thank you.
I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go. That I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten limper, but I won't go with a whimper.